Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
You're listening to Discovery, in-depth science on the BBC World Service, with me, Gaia Vince. For the BBC's A Richer World season, I'm asking, how can we fix the throwaway society?
These are the cords which gives power to the engine.
Yeah. At a community centre in North London, people's broken devices are being mended. This is a restart party, where anyone can bring their electrical and electronic casualties.
Laptops, mobile phones, kettles, toasters. We get all sorts, hedge trimmers. We'll try anything. As long as you can bring it here, we'll try and fix it.
Dave is one of the volunteer restart repairers, showing people the nuts and bolts of how to fix their appliances and gadgets. We'll be checking back in with Dave and his fellow restarters during the programme. Similar events are popping up in cities around the world. It's a grassroots, organised response to our throwaway consumer society and growing mountains of waste electricals, known as e-waste.
People seem to throw away so much these days. The amount of electronic waste which is thrown away just in the UK in one year would fill a line of lorries running from John O'Groats at one end of the country in Scotland down to Land's End right at the far end of the country.
You could have just thrown it away, you could have just bought a new one.
Yeah.
Why did you decide it was worth trying to repair it?
Because it kind of offends me that we're expected to do that in a kind of regular cyclical way. You know, I consider that I bought the thing rather than rented it. And if it can be fixed, then it should be fixed.
It's about recycling stuff. The idea that we just so easily throw things away is just ridiculous when, you know, there is people out there with the knowledge to do it. But then it becomes a cost issue, because is it worthwhile repairing it and having it for a short lease of life, maybe, and you've spent nearly as much to repair it as it did cost to buy it?
So in this programme, we'll look at why it's often cheaper or easier to throw away a device rather than repair it. What could be done to extend the lives of our appliances? And what are the consequences of their careless disposal? And are manufacturers deliberately making stuff to not last?
To me, it just appears that manufacturers are deliberately doing this. They're deliberately making things that have a certain shelf life. I had a toothbrush a while back, a rechargeable toothbrush, and it was a simple matter of the battery needing replacing. But they'd put the battery in the machine in such a way that I was too frightened to tackle it, and it came to a decision whether to throw it out or see whether someone from Restart could do it. And they did, for the price of £6 for a new battery, as opposed to £90 for a new rechargeable toothbrush. And I think manufacturers are deliberately doing this, and they should have some responsibility in helping us look after our environment as well.
That's a common claim, that manufacturers engineer products so that we have to replace them frequently, consuming more than we need to. But is it true? Tim Cooper, Professor of Sustainable Design and Consumption at Nottingham Trent University in the UK.
I wouldn't say there's a kind of conspiracy that products are designed less than they could be for reasons of trying to manipulate the consumer, if you like. Because I think we're all aware that things don't last as long as they used to. But rather, the way that the markets have moved in recent years has been such that there's a huge amount of pressure on price points. Manufacturers work to price points. So if they want to design any item of product, whether it's furniture or an electrical good, they will have in the back of their mind, how much will it sell for and what will our costs be? And over the years, what's happened has been the pressure has been downwards. They're always trying to find ways to cut corners to bring the costs down in order to match their competitors. And what that has led to has been an eroding of quality in many areas.
So do you mean the materials used are of a cheaper quality or a less reliable quality, or do you mean that they're not concerned about, say, a laptop's longevity because they know the next model will be coming out soon?
There are two elements there. There's firstly how it's designed, and very definitely manufacturers look to ways to cut back in costs. Now, that might be using an inferior quality material. It may be just the way it's put together. The design is such that to make it cheap, it's not necessarily going to be easy to access the parts, so it's not going to be repairable. So there are a range of different ways in which manufacturers, in order to try and get their costs down, cut corners, and that reduces the quality. Now, that's not all products. Many manufacturers wouldn't be able to do that because they've got a reputation to maintain. They don't want their customers to be dissatisfied with their products. But broadly speaking, that has happened in many sectors of the market, and we have seen a deterioration in longevity.
Planned obsolescence describes a business tactic to limit the lifespan of products and maximise their consumption. The phrase first cropped up in North America in the 1930s, referring to products designed to break easily or go out of fashion, encouraging consumers to buy more. Kyle Weens is a co-founder of iFixit, an online repair shop that provides parts and fixing guides for devices from smartphones to coffee makers. In consumer electronics, he identifies several strategies employed to encourage us to buy and buy again.
For me, planned obsolescence is a lot of different factors. There's psychological obsolescence. They're designing a product where, you know, a year from now, you know you're going to come out with a product that makes this one look less sexy or less compelling. There's also either, you know, you can have feature obsolescence where you're designing features into the product that you know people are going to need a newer feature that could be something like limiting the storage. This is something that is trivial for manufacturers to add a memory upgrade slot and they haven't done it. And then if you look at what the upgrade price is, what the difference is between a 16-gigabyte phone and a 64-gigabyte phone, and it's £100, and the market price for that memory is £20, you're like, well, wait a second, there's something going on here. The traditional planned obsolescence of we're going to build it with a use where it's going to work for 300 times and then it's going to fail. You see allegations of that in the printer industry. We don't see that as much in other places, although one thing with smartphones, when you build a battery into a smartphone and you make it so the consumer can't replace it, you're building a lifespan into that phone. The physics around batteries allows them to usually work for maybe 300 to 400 charges, and then you have to replace the battery. Well, a lot of manufacturers are now designing batteries into phones where it's the consumer is not able to do that repair. And that's the equivalent of selling a car where the tires are welded onto the car. That would be preposterous, but that's what we're seeing in the cell phone market.
So what do the manufacturers say about this? In HTC's One series of smartphones, the battery is glued into the interior. HTC didn't provide us with an interview, but emailed a statement about why the battery isn't removable.
It's a design decision, as we create each device specifically for a certain market segment, using the structure and materials most relevant on that basis. In the case of the HTC One series, removable batteries are not used, as a number of compromises would then have to be made with regard to the ergonomics and aesthetics of the phone.
In the case of iPhones, Apple argues that so many components are packed into such a small space that it's not technically possible to have a battery that can be removed by the owner. The company will replace a battery for the consumer, but in the US, for example, that comes at a price of $80. Product design tweaks and sophisticated marketing campaigns play their part in encouraging us into frequent upgrades. But we all have a choice about this. Is it time to get out of the cycle? Tim Cooper again.
I think people have got a bit obsessed with having the latest and the newest. They're tempted to buy it by the manufacturer. The evidence suggests that a huge number of mobile phones are stored. They're in people's drawers. They still work. They, in many cases, aren't too different from the one that they replace it with. And I think we need solutions to that problem. The industry has got into a cycle in mobile phones, as with clothing, where there is a cycle. Every year, iPhone brings out a new model. They feel obliged to, regardless of whether or not it's substantially better than the previous version. And I think we've got to find ways of overcoming that and finding a way in which companies can make money, but not do it on the back of a throwaway culture.
Back at the Restart event in North London, I spoke to another of the volunteer repair experts. I wanted to find out what qualified him and motivated him to do it.
I'm Philip, and I've been coming along to these restart parties for just about a year now.
So you've come here to help people,
yes,
with their broken radios and so on. What's your background?
When I was a kid, Oh, good many years ago, I started at the age of about 5 with batteries and bulbs and switches and got interested at that stage. And I then went to university and did an electronics degree, then went on and spent my career in software, actually. But I always kept a keen interest in electronics.
I mean, it's really busy here. So there's a queue of people and a list of objects that need repairing on the board. I mean, it's obviously there is a great need for this and also a great desire to actually have that.
Yes, I think so. Well, people seem to throw away so much electronic waste these days. I heard a statistic a few months ago of the amount of electronic waste which is thrown away just in the UK in 1 year would fill a line of lorries running from one end of the country in Scotland down to the far end of the country. Well, it's so sad to see.
Globally, e-waste is the fastest growing type of garbage. Matthias Schluet researches this problem at the World Resources Forum in Switzerland. Consumers in the industrialised West produce the most e-waste, but the rest of the world is catching up.
There's parts of the world which did not consume so much until now, but they are picking up very fast. Like in the Asian region, we have a steep increase in the consumption of such devices, but also in regions like Africa, people want to use it. They also should use it. And of course, this produces a lot of waste, which is increasing every year.
At Badi University of Emerging Sciences and Technology in India, electronics engineer Pamela Chabla has been forecasting the country's e-waste accumulation rates 10 years from now. Numbers of discarded desktop and laptop computers alone will be in the many hundreds of millions by 2025.
What I have estimated, there would be about 130 million personal computers and 900 million laptop computers, which will become obsolete annually by the year 2025, 10 years from now. The desktop computers, the number would double by that time. And for the notebook computers, the increase would be 8 times.
These increases will be a consequence of there being more Indians with more disposable income.
Very few people are going in for refurbished or second-hand personal computers. Because of the improved economy, most of the people from the middle and upper middle-class families are preferring to buy new ones. Only the lower middle-class people are going in for these second-hand systems.
Damn it.
It's very annoying. That screw is so small.
At the North London Restart Party, I came across a repair job that was not going smoothly. Restarter Dave was trying to get inside the electronics of a gadget brought in by Lucy.
So what's this looks like a voice recorder of some kind, is that right?
Indeed, yes.
It's looking fairly skeletal. You've already removed its skin.
Yes. Not all its skin, I've left its rear end on.
And what happened? It just stopped working?
Yeah, I just couldn't switch it on. And it was a really expensive piece of equipment and I just felt so upset that I just put it in the cupboard and ignored it. Until today when I thought I need to at least try to get it fixed.
So, Dave, you're a repairer here. Are you an electronic engineer?
No.
How do you know what to do here?
I'm an enthusiastic amateur. My day job, I'm an IT guy. I do software on servers, stuff like that. But the more you do, the more you learn. So the real trick is to start repairing things. You might as well get in there and try, because the worst that happens is it didn't work before and it doesn't work afterwards. The best that happens is it gets repaired. And it's one more piece of e-waste not going on the e-waste mountain. And it's a growing problem. Even the manufacturers, I think, would admit, or some of them would maybe, that the current culture is untenable. You just can't keep on producing more and more stuff and chucking it on an e-waste mountain and hoping that it goes away. Because, well, what's going to happen eventually? We're just going to run out of all of those. I mean, if you look at this, the amount of copper, gold for the switch contacts, fancy semiconductor elements, those all have to be mined. And we can't just keep mining them and then throwing them on the scrap heap. This will stop at some point simply because we'll run out of those things.
The quantity of diverse, precious and scarce metals used in electronic equipment shouldn't be underestimated. Matthias Schluep of the World Resources Forum in Switzerland.
If we're thinking of printed circuit boards, so these are the boards we find in the computers with the memories on it, they contain gold. Around 30 mobile phones contain as much gold as you would find in 1 ton of mine rock for mining gold. So that's quite a lot of gold which is available in these devices, which of course drives the price or the value of this waste. On the other hand, also now looking at the mobile phone, this is made up of about half of our periodic table of elements. So you find all kinds of metals in there, and some of them are really scarce. So these are the so-called, for example, the so-called rare earth elements, which are mainly just mined in China. So this is also an issue, of course, that the market is not full of this metal. So you really have restrictions on getting them.
With the right kind of technology, it is possible to extract and recycle metals such as gold and copper from discarded electronic devices. But in many industrialised countries, most are not sent to be recycled. They lie abandoned in people's drawers or end up in the general trash.
Collection is not so good in the European system, which has something to do with the consumer, of course, who maybe doesn't bring it back. Then we are getting to a yield of 20 or 30% of the metals we are getting back, for some of the metals. Now, for the scarce metals I mentioned before, for example, the rare earth elements, we currently don't recycle anything, so they all get lost.
Well, that seems extraordinary because they are so much in demand for making new devices. What's the problem? Why are we not recycling? Why are we not re-extracting from our devices these precious rare earth metals?
There are two things. One thing is that mining these metals is still probably cheaper than recycling it. And this also in turn has something to do with the available technology. The technology available to recycle these scarce metals, which are actually available only in very low concentration also in these devices, it's just not there on a, let's say, economical scale.
Even where metals from e-waste can be recycled, it can create other serious health or environmental problems. Enormous volumes of discarded electricals are processed informally in dangerous ways in developing countries, often by children. Through the international trade in second-hand electrical and digital devices, many broken products end up in countries that lack the technology, infrastructure and regulations to recycle them safely. Matthias Schlueb has studied this in Asia and Western Africa.
Some of this equipment, they arrive and they are not working anymore, or they just work for a very short time. So we can actually consider it a portion of that as waste. And that's around probably from everything which gets exported, 25%. What we found in Western Africa is that every year the volume is equal to what is generated in a small to middle European country. So we're talking about 200,000 tons per year, what gets exported as waste to Western Africa.
Some of this is legally exported, some illegally. Given the consequences of so many devices being dangerously recycled, what needs to be done to minimise the volume ending up being treated this way? Francis Ongondo at the UK's University of Southampton researches e-waste recycling. He says there is much more consumers could do. In the European Union and some states of the USA, for example, manufacturers and distributors of electronic products are legally obliged to help consumers return obsolete devices for safe and responsible recycling.
The producers have a legal obligation and the distributors have a legal obligation, but the consumer does not have a legal obligation. To me, that is one of the key issues. Not only are they not legally obligated to participate in the collection and safe disposal of these products, also there's a problem with awareness. We are not at a point whereby a consumer knows where their products come from. So until the consumer is part of the material supply chain, they know where does this gold come from, what's in a mobile phone, how is it treated, and also know that the material that are used in these products are not infinite, that they're running out. Until we reach that point, we'll always be struggling to collect and recover materials as much as we could.
A restart party is about empowering people to repair their own gadgets, to put off the day when the consumer has to consider recycling them. But how easy is it to mend these products?
Hi, I'm Adam. I'm here with my dad's Apple display, and I'm hoping it's going to live again.
Hi, I'm David. I'm here to help Adam. I'm a restarter to help others, to empower them to fix their own device.
And what happened? It just doesn't turn on.
Yeah, anymore. Just one morning it was just sort of, it just wasn't working. You know, I mean, it's done really well. It's 8 years old or something like that. But I mean, you know, judging by how much it weighs, I think they built it pretty well. Suggest it can be fixed. So.
Did you have a go at fixing it yourself?
No. I'm scared of blowing myself up, so I came here.
Good idea. Yeah. So, what's the problem then, fixer?
We don't know yet because we're looking at opening it up to figure out what might be the problem.
Is it easy to open up?
No, it's not easy at all to open up. Hidden screws behind, you know, glued plastic bits, and probably the hardest part will probably be to open it up than to fixing it afterwards. Hopefully.
I don't think it was the designer's intention that people get in and fiddle about with this thing, but we're gonna try and sort of circumvent that.
And do you enjoy the challenge of discovering what is wrong with your screen and then getting a resolution to it?
Yeah, so far. I mean, I'm very comfortable with mechanical repairs, but I'm very uncomfortable with electronic repairs. It's frustrating that to depend on something on a daily basis that you can't fix is very annoying. So
disempowering.
Very disempowering, yeah. But it's giving me confidence watching this guy kind of, you know, okay, I found there are websites I didn't know, there's people online who've had the same problem. That makes me feel a little bit more up for it. Yeah.
When you say that you don't know anything about electronics, I think you probably know more than you realize. I mean, if you ever change the light bulb, which you probably have done, you know that it's hot when it's on. And so a lot of the problems in closed devices is the fans getting clogged and the heat not getting out, and it's just basically cleaning the fans. So there's a lot of things like that that you're already probably quite up to scratch on things without even realizing it. You know?
Yeah.
My name is Janet Gunter, and I'm one of the co-founders of the Restart Project. I remember one woman came to an event about a year ago, and she said at the end of the event, this is one of the most stressful experiences I've ever had. She had cleaned her laptop by herself, had disassembled it and cleaned it, and she'd never done anything like it. But she said, I overcame my fear. And she said it was really transformative. And it's not just transformative for the person who opens the laptop, it's also for the volunteer who helps, because often these skills are very, very solitary skills, and they're not so shareable. There's not such a social experience around tinkering. Often our volunteers tell us that it's also very transformative for them.
Transformative, but also frustrating sometimes. 15 minutes after starting work on Adam's screen, David still hasn't been able to get inside it. Do you think the manufacturer could have done more to make it easy for you to get inside that box?
Definitely, yes. And for a start, I mean, documenting on how to open it up, which the manufacturer doesn't do. The service manuals are not public.
Europe is talking about better documentation for disassembly and recycling. But what we need, if we're going to maintain products, especially older products, we need service manuals. We need to be able to see how they're assembled. And these are treated as, you know, the utmost secrets, and they're protected by the greatest, you know, intellectual property lawyers. So it's a tough one. And we see them being leaked. You can find many service manuals that have been leaked, and there are some strange economies that have arisen around downloads of leaked manuals, and there's no need for that from our perspective.
Manufacturers such as Apple and HTC say they only make product service manuals available to approved repair companies. Apple said it was not able to provide us with an interview or statement, but HTC sent us this about their service manuals.
We make them available to our trusted commercial partners rather than publicly on the internet, as the complex products we produce require the expertise of trained service technicians so as not to invalidate the warranty.
According to the Association of Computer Repair Business Owners in the United States, although some manufacturers are more open than others in providing service manuals to independent repair businesses, increasing numbers of its members report being denied access to repair documentation. Kyle Weens of the open source repair website iFixit says that the independent repair sector for many products has been in decline for a while now.
We've seen a lot of jobs disappear around the world over the last 20 years. Either there were camera repair shops, there were electronics repair shops, TV repair, and most of those businesses have gone away. And it's a shame that those repair groups never really got together and fought for themselves. in the automotive sector, there's the independent aftermarket auto repair people have gotten together, banded together, and passed right to repair legislation to require that they continue to be able to repair cars. And that's the only reason that you can take your car to an independent garage. In other sectors, in electronics, the repair shops have just given up and gone out of business rather than banding together and passing requirements that manufacturers share information with them.
What we've seen in recent years is the demise of the repair economy.
The phenomenon of a vanishing repair sector in richer countries is confirmed by Tim Cooper, Professor of Sustainable Design and Consumption at Nottingham Trent University. But he suggests there's more to this than the service manual issue.
Fewer and fewer products are repaired, particularly in the West, in the industrialised West. Repair costs tend to be relatively expensive because wages are high, and it's usually therefore cheaper to buy new products than to get things repaired. Manufacturers are vulnerable to any attempt to make things last longer because at the moment, the system at the moment promotes a throwaway culture. Materials are relatively cheap, labour is relatively expensive, and when you've got that kind of price system, you're bound to move towards a society where things don't tend to last, because the interest of the manufacturers is to, as we say, shift as many boxes as possible, and there's no real interest in getting things repaired because it's always labour intensive. So looking at, for example, why things cost as they do, governments have to get involved. Governments have to get involved in things like what's been called green fiscal reform. In other words, instead of taxing labour so much, tax the materials and the energy and reduce the taxes on labour to try and shift this balance so it becomes relatively more cost effective to get something repaired and relatively more expensive to buy new things.
Next week, I'll be looking at how the world might be able to make ever more products, from mobile phones to cars to clothes, for the growing population of consumers, but do so in ways that won't break the planet's bank of natural resources. You've been listening to Discovery from the BBC World Service with me, Gaia Vince.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.